From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Elmwood, Berkeley.
I live in the Haight.
North-ish, Oakland.
Coming up, we'll look at the big turning points that made California's housing market the way it is today, starting with a tax revolt.
People have to pay all these taxes. They don't get nothing for it.
We'll hear how one ballot measure made history and its effects on housing today.
Proposition 13, that's what it was called, and it could take its place alongside no taxation without representation.
And we'll time travel from the creation of public housing projects to the decisions that led to their demise.
So this was actually a Republican invention, but actually what ended up happening, and this is probably an unintended consequence, is it really, in a sense, revolutionized the affordable housing industry.
The housing history we're living with today, coming up on Cross Currents. Today, we're bringing you a special audio adaptation of the short documentary Mad as Hell by Retro Report. It's a look back at the moment in California history that gave birth to Prop 13. More than 35 years later, the law is still on the books, but what has it really meant for the state?
In the 1970s, the nation's economy had hit the skids. An energy crisis meant long lines at gas stations, and inflation was eating away at workers' paychecks. Then, Californians received their property tax bills.
Dolores McCormick, last year, had to pay $646. This year, it's $1,072.
And the state has become an octopus. It's just gobbling up all our little homes, that's all.
Howard Jarvis said the reason he got involved in the tax revolt is he once was helping a woman who was really afraid that her property taxes were going to force her out of her home.
Joel Fox started working with Jarvis in the 1970s.
When he went down to the county building with her, according to Howard, she had a heart attack right there in the building. And it really prompted his theme that he was going to follow. And he says, death and taxes may be inevitable, but being taxed to death is not inevitable.
California's constitution allows anyone with enough popular support to put a proposed law on the ballot. Jarvis, a retired businessman, had tried tax-cutting measures before and gotten nowhere. But with voter anger at a boil, Jarvis proposed a bold idea.
It would cut property taxes 60% on the average, limit them to 1% of market value. To the cities and counties of California, it would mean a revenue loss of at least $7 billion.
For many, those cuts were too harsh. California's governor, Jerry Brown, said the tax cuts would benefit corporations more than homeowners because businesses would receive more of the tax savings.
Brown has campaigned hard against 13, calling it crazy, a bonanza for large landholders and corporations who stand to get the biggest tax savings.
Opponents also pointed out that as a lobbyist for the Los Angeles Apartment Owners Association, Jarvis represented one of the potential big winners, but he countered criticism with a populist message.
After all, the basis of a free country is that government must be limited. And now we've got unlimited government. That brings unlimited taxation. That either brings you into bankruptcy or dictatorship.
So you could tell, this guy is not a Hollywood guy, this guy is not a bright and shiny guy.
Tom Hayden was part of a coalition that fought against Prop 13, but he understood Jarvis's appeal.
He was really not the elite. He spoke for people who felt pinched, economically pinched.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not gonna take this anymore!
Jarvis found inspiration for his Prop 13 campaign in the 1976 Academy Award-winning film, Network.
California historian Mark Paul.
The main character, Howard Beale, becomes a television star by getting on television shouting, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. That was Howard Jarvis's modus. He picked up that line and that persona.
I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Howard Beale's signature line from the movie, I'm mad as hell, struck such a popular chord that Jarvis used it on the cover of his autobiography, and it became a rallying cry for the Prop 13 movement.
They are talking revolution in California. A revolution against taxes and government.
I feel that we just have to stop this excessive spending. I just feel it's just getting out of hand.
Jarvis's popularity soared after he started regularly appearing on a Los Angeles TV station in a series of debates where he took on Prop 13 critics.
Is using this taxpayer revolt, homeowner revolt, to really help, not the homeowner, really.
It's California historian Mark Paul.
But to help the big industrial property
that
owners.
That is the biggest phony deal.
Opponents to Prop 13 argued that it would erode the local services that property taxes helped pay for.
Then-Governor of California Edmund Brown.
It takes too much out of the public sector, $7 billion, which would jeopardize our bonds, our fire department, our police, our schools, our other programs.
But supporters of Prop 13, like former Governor Ronald Reagan, reassured voters that it wouldn't spell disaster because the money saved would be spent generating other tax revenue.
The loss of revenue over any period of time will not happen unless the people bury that $7 billion in a tin can in the backyard.
Prop 13 struck a nerve with voters.
They rolled the dice. The elites told them that this would be a catastrophe, and people just didn't care.
They want to see politicians punished and spending cut.
On June 6, 1978, Proposition 13 won in a landslide.
We, the taxpayers, have spoken. We have made clear our goal. Now,
then-Governor of California Edmund Brown.
It is your responsibility to make Proposition 13 work.
The state got the message.
We have only 3 weeks to act. 3 weeks to decide multi-billion dollars of fiscal questions.
Most school districts have already announced there will be no summer school this year. Not since the Depression years of the 30s has summer school been canceled in California.
Jarvis shrugged off the pending cuts.
Eliminating summer school, I mean, he said that's just babysitting. Art and music and the rest of it. He just said those were frills.
The most important thing in this country is not the school system, nor the police department, nor the fire department, the right to preserve, the right to have property in this country, the right to have a home in this country. That's important.
As California struggled to meet its bills, the architect of Prop 13 became a national sensation, spreading the gospel of tax cutting.
Not many people of Howard Jarvis's background end up with their face on the cover of, you know, national magazines like Time. It made him a celebrity.
Pigs could stretch their limbs out, yeah.
Prop 13 also had another effect. Whether it was this proposition, sponsored by animal protection groups to make farm animals less confined, it passed, or another initiative backed by millions from Texas-based oil companies, which aimed to roll back California's pro-green climate change law. It failed. Voters have since used ballot initiatives like these to amend California's laws more than 75 times.
Kim Alexander, California Voter Foundation.
What Howard Jarvis and the Taxpayers Revolt showed us in the late 1970s was that you can tap into that popular sentiment, that public revolt, and use it to change the law.
In California, anyone with a couple million dollars and an idea can get a measure on the ballot with a chance of getting it passed.
While there have been scores of citizens' initiatives in California, nothing has had more lasting influence than Prop 13. The tax-cutting measure has kept rates low, saving property owners billions, and allowing many to hold on to their homes. But critics say it has also contributed to economic problems.
Today, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger came out with a budget plan that cuts almost everything in sight to try to make up a staggering deficit there.
People that think elections don't matter have to weigh carefully what happened with Prop 13. We're still living with the consequences.
Mayor of Los Angeles, Antonio Villaraigosa.
I've seen what it's done to our schools. We used to be in the top five in per pupil spending. Today, we're closer to the bottom.
We have hundreds of thousands and millions of parents whose children suffered an inadequate education as a result of those schools being cut.
Jennifer Bester, a mom and school volunteer who lives in Silicon Valley, used 2014 property tax data to explore the impact of Prop 13.
This is a property that always interests me because we've got a Walgreens, we've got an Unimas, we've got a Starbucks.
Under Prop 13, property owners who hold property for a long time still pay taxes tied to the original purchase price, regardless of the current market value. Bester says that means owners with similar properties contribute disparate amounts, with some paying much less tax.
We got about 15,000 square feet of space, and it's only paying $9,337 a year in property tax. I'm not an assessor, but I would expect to pay about $75,000 or more a year in property taxes. Essentially, they're getting a $65,000 free ride, which I tend to think of this in terms of school kids. Wow, that's 6.5 kids who could be educated for the amount of money that they're escaping.
Property taxes are supposed to reset to market value when a property is sold, but loopholes have allowed some commercial properties to keep these low tax rates regardless. In 2011, when Jerry Brown became California's governor again, 36 years after his first term, he proposed a new tax on high earners as a temporary fix to help fund schools.
For California's future, vote yes on 30.
He asked people, I've got this idea, rally around me. And he had a vehicle that allowed people to rally around him, and he put it on the ballot and they got to vote. And they did rally around him.
But Prop 30's wealth tax was only a Band-Aid, sunsetting in 2018 unless extended by voters. Critics say an overhaul of Prop 13 that would limit its benefits to homeowners remains part of the solution to California's budget woes.
What we have right now is broken, and we have to fix it. And we need leaders who have the courage to stand up and say, hey, look, why can't we have a rational discussion? This isn't working.
Howard Jarvis died in 1986, but Fox says that any attempt to roll back Prop 13 would still make his old boss and most California homeowners mad as hell.
We'd fly back into Los Angeles. When you fly into Los Angeles to LAX, and you come down and there are thousands of homes, and Howard would be looking out the window more than once and he said, I saved a lot of people their homes.
That was an audio adaptation of Mad as Hell, a Retro Report production by Joe Rubin and Dan McKinney. You can watch the piece in its full visual form and find nearly 100 more of their short docs at retroreport.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. We just heard how Prop 13 cut taxes for homeowners in California, creating budget deficits for the state. Well, since the 1970s, tax cuts and subsidies for homeowners grew at the federal level, too. Meanwhile, subsidies for low-income housing shrank. One thing that means is that public housing projects built long ago have fallen into disrepair, an estimated $26 billion worth of disrepair. Cities can't afford to rehabilitate and maintain these buildings, so they're selling them off. In fact, it was just announced that as of this month, San Francisco's public housing is now all privately run. 3,500 units have been transferred from the city's ownership to various housing groups, some nonprofit and some for-profit. These private developers and banks will make the buildings habitable in exchange for tax credits. And in the case of San Francisco, in exchange for the opportunity to build market-rate housing on the same land. So how did we get here from the original public housing model? In this next piece, we're going to travel back in time with KALW's Liza Veal to see how the story unfolds to the present day.
The story of public housing begins for us here, at a project called Holly Courts. We're in the Bernal Heights neighborhood of San Francisco.
Hi, my name is Adi Nagraj. I work at Bridge Housing Corporation.
And he's going to tell us the origin story.
Holly Courts was built in 1940, and it is the first public housing built west of the Mississippi River.
Bernal Heights didn't look too different than it does today. Just your classic San Francisco neighborhood, where on a steep hill overlooking the Mission District, up further is a park, and the wind is hectic.
The initial set of folks who were here were middle-class families who were either affected by the Depression or coming home from the war.
Now, picture San Francisco back in the 40s. There are African Americans coming into work on the shipyards, there are refugees from the Dust Bowl, there's immigrants from Mexico and China, and there are many, many veterans coming back from Europe and the Pacific. They all need housing, and the market is not providing it.
I see one third of a nation ill housed, ill clad, ill nourished.
Remember, we're just coming out of the Great Depression, the war. It's hard times, but it's hard times for everyone. The country is actually unusually unified. So the Roosevelt administration decides to do something the federal government has never done before. Make housing a basic right. Make it the government's problem. So Holly Quartz goes up on this hill, and so do projects all over the country.
We show you a few of the hundred of thousands of men whom it has put back to work, some of them after years of idleness. Carpenters, bricklayers, masons, plumbers, men from every division of the building trades are getting an honest day's work.
In the 1940s, the wealth gap was much less pronounced than it is now, and so people and families could really move in public housing temporarily, and after they accrued a certain amount of savings, they could move on to different housing options. And currently,
that's not the case, because the wealth gap has widened the gulf between expensive market rate prices and low-income affordable prices.
And currently, those housing options don't exist anymore.
By the 1950s, the dynamics in American cities had changed. White flight rearranged the demographics of the urban spread. And as affluent whites strained out of cities, so did American popular support for inner-city services.
As populations became more mixed and the clientele living in public housing became more black and brown, I do think that had an impact on politicians in D.C. on how much they wanted to fund a lot of urban initiatives such as housing and transportation.
So housing projects are created in a bout of patriotism, and then once politics shift, begin to be defunded and continue to be defunded every single year up until the present. Flash forward to the 1970s. The country has been through several social rights movements, and now there's a conservative backlash.
Well, the trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
Welfare and public housing are beginning to be termed entitlements by people like Governor Ronald Reagan of California. At the local level, affluent people are beginning to move back to cities, snapping up properties. Sound familiar?
Today, they're submitting a list of demands to Moscone, asking that he stop the threat of eviction once and for all.
By a strange convergence of history, neighborhood activism in San Francisco and a Reagan tax break program came together to create a new era in affordable housing. Here's how.
It was a very, very scary time. I'm Malcolm Young.
Malcolm Young is head of the Chinatown Community Development Corporation. He's going to take us through this part of the story. The place is Chinatown, 1970.
This was the time when San Francisco really started thinking about itself as a modern financial capital. And this was the era during which the financial district was expanding.
We're standing on the corner of Kearney and Jackson, looking at the International Hotel, a dormitory-style, single-room occupancy building. Hotels like this are the cheapest way to get a roof over your head, and they're all over the eastern and central part of the city. That's about to change.
So what was happening was a lot of these four-story SRO hotels built for these migrant workers were being bought by developers, residents were being evicted, the buildings were being demolished, and they were all being rebuilt as high-rises. And it was literally eliminating Little Manila on a building-by-building basis. It was threatening the elimination of Chinatown.
This is actually the moment where we start to see homelessness emerging on a real scale. So this SRO, the I Hotel, becomes the site of a particularly fierce battle between the Chinatown community and the police.
The community is sick of it, the community is tired of it, and the I Hotel on the corner of Kearney and Jackson becomes the last stand.
In order to protect the I Hotel, the community forms a human barricade. It lasts off and on for 7 years, until August 4th, 1977, midnight, when the police have everyone forcibly removed.
The sheriff at that time came and literally broke through the human barricade by bringing in horses and dragging the seniors who lived in this hotel literally out of the building.
Activists respond by taking affordable housing into their own hands. They begin forming community development corporations, or CDCs, and the city government works with them, eager to help avoid another iHotel disaster.
And the CDC movement, at least for Chinatown, really literally sprang out of the ashes of iHotel. The way that we started things was, rather than doing new construction, which was way too expensive at the time,
they would use city loans to buy buildings and rent them out on the cheap at no profit to themselves. This is an altogether different animal from the old federal public projects or other European or Scandinavian programs. At the moment the CDC's come up, Reagan has become the president, and he's building a strong conservative movement against government spending. His idea of solving the problem of affordable housing is to create a tax credit program that allows big corporations to invest in low-income housing.
So this was actually a Republican invention. And, you know, it was really motivated by kind of the idea of creating a tax break. But actually what ended up happening, and this is probably an unintended consequence, is it really, in a sense, revolutionized the affordable housing industry because it started bringing in large amounts of money into affordable housing.
So while the CDCs probably would have opposed Reagan's cuts to public housing, they happen to be perfectly positioned to capitalize on the new private and nonprofit sector solution. The main point is that now we have a whole set of private stakeholders and middlemen that invest in and profit from the industry. An industry, remember, that is funded in large part with tax credits. I asked Malcolm if it wouldn't be a much more efficient use of tax money to fund the housing directly through the government.
So I think the big risk for us in that model is if you put all your eggs in that basket, you're in a situation where the amount of housing that you can do is entirely dependent upon the political whim of where the country is at the time.
That's what happened when we went from Jimmy Carter to Ronald Reagan.
That's true of the state. That's true of, you know, of the local jurisdiction. And you could be flush one year, and then you could be dry for the next 10 years. And I think with individual entities who are able to leverage several different sources of funding, it puts you in a situation where if one source dries up, you can try to figure out if there's a pathway somewhere else.
So most of the new affordable housing construction today is done by these nonprofit developers. Today, they're just like private developers. The only difference is they pay less taxes, they don't distribute income to shareholders and investors, and they often, though not always, build low-income housing in partnership with public funds. That's today. But whatever became of all those projects we built a half century ago? We have one last stop on our trip.
If you were to come out to Sunnydale, you would actually not believe that this place exists in a city that looks like San Francisco.
That's Tamika Moss with the Department of Housing for the Mayor's Office. We're in Visitation Valley, a neighborhood near the Cow Palace. Here's what Sunnydale looks like.
It's really spread out, and it isn't very dense, and it looks like row housing. There's yards in between, there's bars on the windows, there's a lot of boarded up buildings. So you drive up the main drag here on Sunnydale and you see a lot of abandoned looking housing projects.
In the half century since they were built, public projects have demonstrated exactly what fails when we concentrate poverty. People get stuck, they get in trouble. Nearly half of the city's homicides this year have been in or around the Sunnydale area. So the city is taking a bit of federal money, combining it with local dollars, and partnering with developers to fix up the projects. But we're not just talking about cleaning up mold. We're talking about transforming the site into a neighborhood where economic mobility is visible. The theory is they can do this by building mixed income units among the projects. This initiative, HOPE-SF, is a public-private partnership. Here's the plan.
These are one- and two-story buildings on 50 acres of land. So we're going to build up a little bit so that you can have affordable housing units, you can have workforce housing, and you can have market rate housing, and you build an integrated mixed income community that way. So you wouldn't be able to tell a public housing unit from a market rate unit.
This is how affordable housing works now. There's no standardized program from the federal government, and the state of California has disbanded its main source of funding, known as redevelopment. So cities are innovating these kinds of programs along with the industry. The partnership is resulting in better, safer, more community-oriented housing. But it also puts us at the mercy of the marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Liza Veal for Cross Currents.
That story originally aired in 2014. And that's it for Cross Currents today. Our team includes Leela Day, Olivia Henry, Jurgen Klemm, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, James Rowland, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, Kovalroop Singh, Andrew Stelzer, and Bowen Wang. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Liza Veal. Jen Chien is our managing editor. Julie Kane is our managing producer. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.